can see there's a group of German hackers who've made a device that can basically read these phones. Mm-hmm. And they've now built another one that can basically act like a virtual card.
Okay.
And if you go to holtonpcb.org, you will find it. PCB.org.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank
you. Okay, so we'll resume to talk about sensor networks. Now, sensor networks, of course, build upon the idea of these mobile ad hoc networks, often called MANETs. So here we have an ad hoc network, which means these devices need to discover each other, form links with each other, and then communicate. But we can now combine those together with mobile IP, and we get something called MIP MANETs. And if you follow that paper, it's a paper with some former students of mine at the very first conference that ACM organized about MANETs. And the interesting thing there is it showed how using multiple gateways between mobile ad hoc networks combined with mobile IP can give you some very nice features. Okay, what are sensor networks for? Well, the goal is often things like environmental monitoring, traffic, heating, ventilating, air conditioning, security, industrial, sensing and diagnostics, infrastructures, battlefield awareness, logistics, packed smart packages, etc., and personal health monitoring, etc. A wide spectrum of concerns from the hardware through the energy and the protocols. We'll just take a look at it first by looking at some patterns of communication. It's important to remember that many of these devices are simply going to be one-to-one communications, and it's going to be simplex. They're only going to send data out. Okay? And some of these sensors are very simple. Things like smoke and fire detectors in rooms. Right? They don't need to receive packets. They just need to send a packet out saying, hey, I'm okay. I don't see any smoke. And the temperature's fine. Right? And if they do that, sending it perhaps one a second or so, a small battery can last a decade. Right? And it's much cheaper than running wires around to all of these things. We can also have one-to-one full duplex. We can have one-to-many and many-to-one. But it's quite common in sensor networks that the communication is asymmetric. We don't have an equal amount of data flowing in both directions. In fact, we may not even be able to communicate in some cases in one direction. Now we can have mediated communication where A sends to B and B forwards it to C, and we can do that, of course, in full duplex. We can have multicast routing where one copy is sent from A to B and then B replicates it. And we can, of course, have unicast routing. So in all of these cases, B is the intermediary. But in the case of sensor networks, it's very common to actually have the node transform the value. So in the simplex case, when B arrives at B, B computes some function of B and sends the value on. And we can do that in both directions. B can also do it for distribution. So one copy arrives here, it distributes them. But the most interesting case is aggregation, where D, E, and C send their data in, B computes some function of those arriving values, and sends a new packet out to A. So for instance, you might have a bunch of sensors and you want to know where's the hottest place in the building, right? And what's its temperature? So the intermediate nodes simply gather all the incoming packets that they receive, find the maximum, take the address of the maximum and the maximum value and forward it on. And you just keep doing that, and at the controller, lo and behold, you find out where's the highest temperature and what's that high temperature. And of course you can do this in all the various sorts of routing. Multicast routing, unicast routing, and even ad hoc routing. So in ad hoc routing, it basically splits into two different forms. Proactive, where we maintain routes to all the destinations, whether we have data to send or not, and reactive routing, where we only compute the route when we actually have data to send there. The problem in proactive routing is, while the delay to forward is very short because we know all the routes, the problem is we're often sending data around for routes that are never going to be used. Right? Whereas in the reactive case, the problem is we receive a packet, we need to figure out where to route it to, but we don't know. Okay, so now we have to figure out where to route it to. Now, Professor Deborah Estrin and her group at UCLA have said, as a hypothesis, that internet technologies plus ad hoc routing is sufficient to design all sensor network applications. Now, this is a hypothesis. There isn't proof yet, although she and her group are very smart. They've been working for more than a decade now to show that this is true and to build applications that exploit wireless sensors. Well, in addition to having simplex communication from A to B, A can simply emit a stream of data over time. Once a second, once an hour, whatever. We can also have patterns where A sends a request to B, B may do some computation or measure something, etc., and then send a response. And then we can have streams of transactions. And we may have to choose different patterns depending upon what we do. And of course, we saw earlier that we can have routers to interconnect these various different networks. But we saw that there was this split between infrastructure networks and pure ad hoc networks. And in pure ad hoc networks, what we typically find is each of these figures out what the best link is, but the problem is all of this traffic here, if it's being sent to here, all has to pass through this one node. So we basically have one hotspot. And if this is a battery-powered node, what soon happens? Right? It runs out of battery power. So none of these nodes can communicate to the rest of the network because it all has to go through this node. And we'll see an alternative way to avoid these hotspots a little bit later. But one way we can avoid them is, in fact, to connect different points in the network to an infrastructure. And thus, there isn't one little hotspot everything has to route through to get to this data sink. Adding the access points reduces delay. However, it increases some of the complexity of the nodes, the ones that are going to be attached to the infrastructure. It requires connectivity between those points, and it may actually increase power consumption. Now, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is responsible for doing and promoting research to support the U.S. Department of Defense, put forth in 1999 a proposal for sensor information technology where they said the single-purpose centralized systems, this isn't the future. We want network-based approaches where sensors can be dynamically multitasked from multiple points. Why? Because they just simply couldn't afford to keep buying lots and lots of different incompatible systems. So they said sensors are going to be tightly integrated with general-purpose CPUs, wireless communications, memory, and multiple sensors can be associated even with a node, short-range communications with tens to tens of thousands of sensor computers. Well, if we start having tens of thousands of sensor computers, are you going to go around with your little screwdriver adjusting their address? No. They need to spontaneously create an ad hoc network. They need to self-configure. Ideally, you simply, spread them out randomly, put them in artillery shell, disperse them in a cloud, etc. And there's some people who are looking at having, Avogadro's number worth of sensors. That means that we can expect there to be failure. Right? And some people have found that this is a very important thing to understand. If you know there's going to be failure and you plan for failure, then when failure occurs, what happens? there's no problem because you plan for failure. Right? The big difficulty is when you plan without thinking about failure, because now when failure occurs, oops, we're screwed. Okay? So making the system spontaneously configure itself, assemble the network itself, dynamically adapt, this means we can even manage movement of sensors, failures of sensors, and now if we add it to the ability to give it new tasks dynamically, we can turn it into different sorts of networks, in some cases by adding new devices dynamically to the network, saying, oh, I never thought about measuring the pH of the soil. Well, okay, let me add some nodes that know how to measure pH, or know how to measure turbidity of water, or know how to measure, etc. And I can just keep adding them to my network, and I keep getting, yes, more and more value out of my network. This means that it isn't possible to go and visit all of these individual nodes, and we have to deal with frequent changes in position, reachability, power availability, tasking, etc. So you all understand they have to be reconfigurable. That lets us do incremental deployment. We don't need central administration. We dynamically adapt, and we can mix types of sensors, as I just said. But we had this problem about hotspots. Well, Wendy, now Heitzeman, introduced this idea called low-energy adaptive clustering hierarchy. And in her dissertation, she said, well, what we need to do is we need to have the local nodes cooperate together and form a cluster and nominate one of the members of the cluster to be a cluster head. And what this cluster head is going to do is it's going to take responsibility for communicating from this cluster to the cluster head who's responsible for this other cluster. Okay? The advantage now is if you have every once in a while everybody swaps what they're doing and somebody else becomes the cluster head, yes, you spread the power utilization across all your nodes rather than concentrating all of the power utilization in just a couple nodes. And that idea of cluster heads has turned out to be very powerful. Another issue is so-called spin protocols, the sensor protocols for information via negotiation. And here the idea is that often you want to disseminate information. You want to distribute it. Well, you can do that, of course, by flooding, by gossiping, etc. But you can also think about assigning high-level names, i.e., we can now have metadata. So now you can announce, hey, I'm interested in information of the following type. That request propagates out in your network. And now anyone who has that kind of data says, hey, I heard about a request for this kind of data from this node in that direction. So what do I do? I keep forwarding it back in that direction until it reaches the node who has expressed interest in that kind of data. You note the interesting thing here. This didn't involve addressing. It involved naming the data. Okay. And you can read lots more about spin. There's been lots of work done there. So, typically the systems in the past have been very centralized. That leads to single point of failure, bottlenecks, energy inefficient, etc. It's moving towards coordination, and as I said, these clustering type of approaches with dynamic election of cluster heads. So, if we take the work that was done, and we combine that with work done by John Heidemann et al., where we use this naming, we can now think about sensor fusion in route. So, as these bits of information were propagating back to this node, do each copy have to go back? Well, sometimes no. Instead, we can aggregate the data together and we can say, over in this direction, I got a value of this, propagates back, I learn, aha, it's really hot over there. Right? And that may be sufficient. Or I hear lots of vibration over there. So, Data aggregation can be, of course, scalar computations, things like summing, averages, computing medians, or it can be logical operations. Has anyone detected this? If nobody, boom, fine. A big problem, however, is avoiding these hotspots. Approaches are things like directed diffusion, data naming, publishing, etc. And you can read lots about this. So what does a task look like? A task might say, for this period of time, I'm looking for a four-legged animal. I want to look for this period of time. So with sampling of this rate, but over 10 seconds within this area, I want data. And the result is I can, yes, find this four-legged animal. It's a type of elephant. It's at this location with 85% confidence. And I think I spotted it 120:40. So how did I know it was an elephant? Well, I could extract data like acoustic data, seismic data, the pattern of the elephant walking along. And by collecting that set of data and doing computations like waveform matching and so forth, I can say, right? Looks like an elephant, smells like an elephant, walks like an elephant. Hey, it's probably an elephant. But I may not be completely sure, so I give it some conditional probability. And although you laugh, in a country where the U.S. was not at war, where, of course, we never were, allegedly, sensors like this were deployed to detect the fact that people's footsteps, while walking along carrying heavy burdens, would tell you, troops are being resupplied. Okay, you know that they're getting resupplied. You know how much supplies are being moved, etc., simply by the vibration caused by people walking. One of my colleagues talks about the fact that you can even identify people by the way they walk. So, you can get an amazing amount of information by fusing the right sources of information. Another issue is to exploit caching, because now we can keep local caches. So the result is when the request arrives saying, hey, how hot is it over there? If I recently learned how hot it was, I can cache that and simply take the value out of the cache and forward it back. I don't have to keep propagating the request. Now at some point, of course, I have to say yes. My value in the cache is old, so I better propagate a request and find out again. But by exploiting caching, I can, again, reduce my energy consumption, increase the scalability, increase robustness, but at the cost of sometimes having stale data. And if I combine that with down-converting, which may mean the source doesn't need it with as much resolution as I have, I can, of course, reduce my network traffic even more. And there are lots of issues that you can consider when trying to deal with how to diffuse data. There are metrics for evaluating it. There are problems about dealing with congestion. There are tiered architectures with simple nodes, more complex nodes, etc., with ever-increasing power budgets. There are even nodes that are called excreters, and basically what they do is they go around and power up these nodes, give them more of the chemical that they need, maybe even locally manufacture materials. Not surprisingly, one of the big problems is that if I just throw sensor nodes out, how do they know where they are? Right? So I hear this report saying, the temperature is 25.7 degrees C, and I'm sensor number 8,256. How do I know where that is? Well, we need to do localization. And that may be map-based, surveying-based, using some external markers, but the most common is actually having the devices iteratively figure out where they are, map their own locations. How do they do that? Well, they compute a bunch of measurements and solve a problem in distributed constraint solving, all having to deal with, of course, dealing with the time, space, complexity, and energy bounds that they have. But it's a big issue, and there have been lots of papers written about this. Another important area in sensor networks is synchronization, both to coordinate sensor sampling and to organize the hops and to decide when we're transmitting and when we're listening. There have been lots of work on high-precision clocks. The bad problem is high-precision clocks take lots of power. There are approaches that simply say, hey, if I want to know what time is, listen to GPS because somebody's broadcasting the time. And there's a very interesting activity called chip-scale atomic clocks, which is a DARPA project. And they figured out how to make a single chip atomic clock. Okay, anyone know what an atomic clock is? Yes? It's an extremely precise clock because it typically measures time in terms of the oscillation rates of rubidium atoms or something like that. The result is you can have an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 15th or 1 part in 10 to the 17th. So extremely precise time. Now what's the advantage of a node having an extremely precise knowledge of the time? Well, if it wants to communicate with another node, what do? You agree on a schedule. And so now you both go to sleep until it's just before the scheduled time. Then what do? The one who's going to transmit powers up. The one who's going to receive powers up just before it's time to receive, receives the message, immediately goes back to sleep. Okay? So you can reduce your power levels tremendously, but only if, of course, you wake up in time. Because if you wake up too late, you miss the message. If you wake up too early, what happens? You burn lots of power unnecessarily. So this is a very, very, very fascinating area. And I don't know what's going to be the future of it. Yes? No, it's a rubidium atom. It's the fact that, you know, if you look at a vapor containing atoms, and you basically probe it either optically or RF, these things are oscillating. They have a natural oscillating frequency. Right? The electrons are orbiting around the thing, etc. It has some frequencies. So what I do is I just observe that and measure it and say, count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And I can keep time based on that. Because it's related to the natural processes that occur in these atoms. As far as I know, rubidium, I'll ask my wife, is rubidium radioactive? There are no radioactive major isotopes of rubidium, are there? Yeah, but not many. I mean, they're not using radioactive rubidium. Okay. Good. Thank you. Check with an expert. Okay. So we could build upon synchronization and localization to do things like take two visual viewpoints, get stereo images. One of my favorite things, you know, for spying, you're in the harbor, you have your camera, it's GPS equipped, you take a picture of the boat, you walk elsewhere in the harbor, you take a picture of the boat, you put the data together, boom, you know how much cargo the boat's carrying. Right? Because you can compute the displacement of the boat. Trivial things, but very powerful. Combining multiple acoustic points of view with phased array microphones. So I can track where the user is by the sound. And for those of you who have Vista, it now supports phased array microphones. We can use multiple accelerometers. We can use multiple visual viewpoints, etc. Another problem is, of course, you're transmitting all of this data over typically radio frequencies or optical frequencies. There's an issue about how do I protect it? Both how do I preserve privacy, but how do I make sure that the message that arrives is the message that I actually sent? And that typically means digital signatures. Oops, the bad problem is digital signatures are typically long. That means I end up with lots of bits. That's not very good because I have a very limited computation and energy budget. And so there's been work by Gennaro and Rohagi trying to understand how can I have very small signatures this case, 300 bytes per packet. And one of the techniques they've proposed is something called Tesla. And if you're interested, you can read about it in MicroTesla. Another approach is to use a protocol called Secure RTP, the real-time protocol. And one of my former students, Elisabetta Carrera, is one of the major people behind this. And this lets you have replay protection plus privacy plus security plus authentication at the cost of perhaps 4 additional bytes per packet. That's very nice. That's what you like when you're trying to keep your power budget low. There have been lots of projects to build all sorts of different sensors. There's a company called MillennialNet that builds these little things they call I-beams. They're about 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters. They have a 10-year lifetime on a coin cell, but they only transmit once per second. There's even some projects called Smart Dust. And here the idea is to build a sensor system that's 1 cubic millimeter. Therefore, the volume means I only have about 1 joule of power. But, of course, if I'm going to transmit much at all, we have the problem that it takes about 1 nanojoule to do 32 instructions and about 100 nanojoule per bit to transmit, even with Bluetooth. So about 1 nanojoule per bit, I've got a problem. Right? I can compute or I can transmit, but if I both compute and transmit, I soon run out of battery power. And because it's so small, it can only get about 1 millijoule per day by getting power from lighting. Or with a solar cell, it can get a bit more. So there's been lots of work done here. One approach is to say, hey, powered externally by using corner cube retroreflectors. A group at Berkeley has been building these very small little sensor platforms called the Berkeley Motes, and there's a commercial version of it. 8-bit processors, low frequency, 916 megahertz, low data rates, very small operating system, 3,500 bytes, a total of, yes, 4,500 bytes of available space when you start out with 8K. And there are people who built entire TCP/IP protocol implementations in this, and there's a group at 6 working on this. And you can read lots more about the prototype. Not surprisingly, you can do all the various sorts of routing that we talked about. And after you've routed the data out to somewhere external to the network, what do you do with all the sensor data? And so there's this project called vSpace, and it basically says, what do you do? You build a distributed data structure and put all the sensor data in it. So now it can be queried easily by users, and in many cases, you may find the data already available, and you don't even have to send a task into the network to do it. If you do, you can go and get it. And there are commercial versions like Crossbow sells these things. Now, there's a group at MIT that was doing low-power VLSI design for these sorts of sensors, and it's most important, I think, for this wonderful poster by Rex Min and his advisor. It's called The Top 5 Myths About Energy Consumption of Wireless Communication. And for those of you who have seen shows like David Letterman, okay. And number 5 is abstraction gets in the way of energy savings. And the answer is false. It turns out you can actually do really good abstraction and create APIs that let you control it. Myth number 4, right? Everyone knows what a myth is, right? Something that people widely believe but it's false. Energy quality scalability doesn't work for wireless. Oops, that's false. Derivatives of 802.11 will drive emerging low-power networks. Oops, wrong. Power levels are too high. Myth number 2, communication energy scales. So he said, okay, you can compute energy per bit based on the distance between the nodes and this equation. And then he actually measured those terms for a number of systems. And one of the surprising systems that we see here is a system that is a Theros 802.11a running at 54 megabits per second, takes only 14.8 nanojoules for the constant A and 11 nanojoules for constant B. It's one of the most energy efficient systems there, but yet it's a radio that runs at 54 megabits per second, as opposed to these things, which run a mere 2.4 kilohertz. wow, at least to me, that seems initially counterintuitive. Why should a system running at much, much higher clock rates be more energy efficient? Anyone want to guess why? Yes. Right, so the neat thing is actually by transmitting faster, it means I can go to sleep sooner. Right, the amount of time I'm emitting power decreases tremendously. And that turns out to be one of the keys to getting really low power. And that's in the end why, of course, ultra-wideband is really good, because I produce these picosecond long bursts. It doesn't take me very long to send my whole message, and then I don't have to expend any more energy. And myth number one, multi-hop saves energy. And the interesting thing is, lots of people believe two hops are better than one, right? So rather than transmit a very long way, the theory was I would transmit to an intermediary who would receive it and then transmit it again, because that took less power. And the answer is, it's never true. Since the multi-hop energy exceeds the single-hop energy. And the reason is, the intermediary had to be awake and their receiver running to receive the incoming message. Then they had to transmit the message, and another receiver had to receive it. So we had to receive it twice and transmit it twice. Oops, it's very hard to do that in less energy than just sending it and receiving it once. Then there are these series of smart badges that Professor Mark Smith and I did before Mark was here. And you can talk to numerous people around here who've used them. There are lots of issues about power. You get it from batteries, supercapacitors, fuel cells, harvested from energy like vibrational sources, etc. But the dilemma that Professor Estrin and her colleagues have pointed to is the fact that unfortunately, it seems that in sensor networks, the only optimal way of solving a problem results in algorithms whose communication energy exceeds their benefits. Oops. Yes. So the problem is, you need a better strategy to use algorithms that only look for good enough through suboptimal results and only need local distributed processing with minimum communication. Right, so we can either get a globally good solution, but unfortunately we have no battery power to be able to then do anything else, or we can get a suboptimal solution, and maybe it's good enough. And then we have enough power to be able to get another suboptimal solution, and we can keep doing that. So this has been very interesting. It means you need to think in terms of adaptive duty cycles, and not looking for global optima. People have developed sensor ML, sensor modeling language. So there's an XML for writing about sensor data. One of the standards that's very important today, which we mentioned earlier, is 802.15 for these personal area networks. We talked about ultra-wideband. Oops, why are we going that way? Ah, yes. Active networks. In active networks, instead of just computing a function that's fixed at B, we actually send along the program plus the data, and the router, as it were, applies the function to the data. And that means we can actually send programs out and do some very, very interesting things. And one of my former doctoral students, Jonathan Smith, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, has been very active in this area of it. Active networks. This, of course, means that these devices along the way have to worry about things like having a virtual machine that they execute this program in that you send along, so it doesn't affect the next packet that arrives with potentially a different program. Right? Because otherwise, you would have an incredible, wonderful set of viruses. The main techniques used for work in wireless sensor networks has been analytic typically graph theoretic models, simulation, often using the network simulator called NS2, and small-scale experiments with very, very few large-scale experiments. There are bunches of conferences. The first European workshop on wireless sensor networks was in January 2004 in Berlin, and then there have been plenty since, and there are lots of conferences to go to, and plenty of further reading. The interesting thing to me is that sensor networks have often been this very, very separate, specialized area. They have typically focused usually on problems either for the military or people wanting to throw up networks very quickly because there's a disaster or emergency or something like that. And it's often been viewed as very specialized. But I think we can draw from that a number of interesting things that are useful in other settings. And one of those, of course, as we mentioned yesterday, is the issue about delay-tolerant networks, where we don't have end-to-end connectivity, we don't have low round-trip times, we don't have access to a global DNS or something like that, and where we have to exploit opportunistic exchange of messages and use techniques like epidemic routing. In particular, exploiting things like social networks and commuting patterns. But a hard problem is, what's the right amount of data to bundle into one of these delay-tolerant network data transport units? How much data do we send? How often do we copy it and send replicates via different paths, hoping that one of them arrives? And the metrics for success are usually delivery ratio, delay, and delivery cost. So an interesting approach here is one adopted by Space Data Corporation. And Space Data Corporation basically said, hey, for decades we have been launching, or the government has been launching for our benefit, weather balloons. And they send these weather balloons, and they go up to about 100,000 feet, so 30,000 kilometers. They stay there for about 1.5 days, and they drift as the winds at high altitude are blowing them along. And they typically have a little radio repeater in them. And we know where they are because they can have GPS in them. And the U.S. National Weather Service actually gets 18% of them back by just putting a mailing address and promising to pay the postage. And they've been doing this for 60 years. So Space Data went and got a license for 1.4 megahertz of bandwidth across the U.S. And they did this together with a number of Indian nations, which are tribal regions, which are autonomous entities. And what they basically said is, hey, there are these big regions where there are very few people that have no communications infrastructure because there's too little money, too big an area, and too few people. And they said, well, what happens? Well, these balloons are going to drift slowly by overhead. And since they keep putting up balloons actually twice a day, that means almost all the time there's a balloon somewhere within range that I could use to communicate up to that balloon and relay to a place that does have connectivity into the fixed infrastructure. And so the result is, in a very short period of time, they provided connectivity over this area at a cost of about $300 for the repeater attached to the balloon. And the balloons are already there. So sort of like putting the radios on the lamppost that we talked for ricochet, they just went to the weather service and said, hey, would you let us stick this extra module in when you're putting these balloons up? And voila, they were a nationwide wireless connectivity provider, accomplishing something hadn't been done by any operator, and no operator was willing to spend the money to provide connectivity on the ground. Now in Sweden, an interesting version of this is, as some of you probably know, the S-Range in the north of Sweden launches these very high altitude balloons. And the U.S. military and others have these drones that fly around for days and days and days at lower altitudes. And people are starting to say, hey, we use them as radio relays. So we put up an infrastructure by launching a bunch of balloons or having orbiting drones, instead of having to worry about putting up towers. Right? What's the difficulty about putting up towers? Yes. Okay, he says the cost. Anyone have another thing that might be a problem? Okay, one is it may not be high enough. Power. What else? Permission. This is the biggest problem. Yes, you can put up cellular towers, but not in my backyard. Right? And this today is becoming one of the major bottlenecks for people fielding new wireless infrastructure. And that's why a requirement in many places, such as Sweden, is co-location. We have one mast and we put all the different operators' antennas on one mast. But we still had to get permission to put it there. What's the best thing about having a balloon at 30,000 meters? Is it in my backyard? Well, maybe. Right? So the result is we get to skip all of that. Now, does it matter whether it's 30 kilometers this way or 30 kilometers this way that I have to send a signal? Since you've looked at base station sighting and you mentioned altitude of the antenna, is it better to try to send a signal 30 kilometers this way or 30 kilometers this way? Okay, he says this way. Why? No, it's better to send it up, right? Because there are fewer things in between me and it. So almost all the time I have line of sight. Whereas if I go this way, I keep hitting other things. So there's actually a benefit from going up. So although space data might have seemed strange, there's lots of interesting things shaping up in that realm. There are also people building intelligent and smart spaces, and you can read about these things. But the biggest issue is the problem about how to do that automatic configuration. And sadly, systems like Sun's Genie and Microsoft's Universal Plug and Play, don't work very well. They don't solve the problem. In particular, Genie has the problem that it expects all of these devices to have Java virtual machines. And that may or may not be true. So you have to ask yourself, what would happen if wireless LANs were widely available? For instance, in the places where you spend most of your time. So what would happen if in some X percentage of these places, let's say X is greater than 90%, you had wireless LAN connectivity? And let's say that you had voice over IP over wireless LAN. Then is there a business case for 3G in urban settings? No. So if I walk around in my neighborhood in Stockholm, and as one of my neighbors has said, there is no place in the neighborhood that doesn't have wireless LAN connectivity. So why would you use a 3G handset? Right? Pay higher rates, use more battery power? Okay. Nah, you want to use the wireless LAN. If you expand that and you say, well, gee, wireless LAN base stations are real cheap, you start putting them everywhere, then is there a business case for 3G? And some would question whether that's true. With 802.11n, is there a business case for LTE? And there was a very nice presentation this past week by one of the regulators from Ofcom arguing that one of the problems is there's too little increment between 3G and LTE to make it worthwhile spending lots of money to increase the data rates further because they're already quite high. There are issues about handoffs, and Broadcom today has built a Wi-Fi reference design that includes mobile voice over IP and wireless LAN in, yes, a two-chip chipset. So what are the traditional wide area cellular operators doing about this? Well, they said, what we could do is we could combine an access point using either unlicensed or licensed radio spectrum, and when you're near it, we'll hand off to this so-called unlicensed mobile access, UMA device, and will go through the IP network to interconnect with the core mobile network. And so if you're in Denmark today, UMA is appearing all over the place. It's being done by one of the cellular operators. Not, however, the major cellular operator, but one of the smaller cellular operators that's trying to get into this market. Why? Because they know most of the people spend large amounts of time at home, and we could do the same thing in their office. There's only a small amount of time they're out in the larger wide area space when we actually have to carry them in our cellular network. So even with a lower capacity cellular network, yes, we have lots of happy customers. And what's the advantage of having happy customers? You take their money. That's right. They keep paying their money because they're happy. So UMA is an interesting play. And the details of it can be described here, but the nice thing is you'll recognize basically all of these same things that we've discussed before. Near-field communications, just another comment about it. An interesting thing, which we mentioned, is things like context-dependent multicards. But the communication ranges are very short distance and very low data rates. And if you want to hear more about radio frequency identification, see Professor Mark Smith's course on this topic, which I think is running now, or was just. It was just. So you have to wait for next year for it. Another area is cognitive radios, and I mentioned this as in the dissertation work of Joe Mitola, and this is an extremely active area today to understand how to use dynamic spectrum. So a question that came up earlier today was, well, isn't there a shortage of spectrum? And the answer is no, because lots of the analog telephony systems are gone. The analog TV stations are being shut down. And so the result is there's hundreds of megahertz of spectrum that's become available, even in relatively low frequency bands, if only we use it cleverly. And in some cases, we may even be able to reuse spectrum that's actually allocated for things like television in places where it isn't being used, or perhaps during the hours it's not being used. So dynamic spectrum usage, instead of, whoops, we're going to assign this band for 20 years to only be used for this purpose. That's the old model of regulation. It's ending, both in the UK and in Sweden. The other is secondary spectrum users. These users basically have tables saying, I'm allowed to use these frequencies when no one else is using them and I'm in these geographic areas. But if I hear someone else using it, then I can't use it. I'm a secondary user. And in Joe Mitola's thesis, he even discusses the fact that if you look at the amount of spectrum that's allocated for things like the military to use in times of national emergency, etc., it's huge amounts of spectrum. Thankfully, right, we aren't at civil war. So guess what's happening to most of that spectrum? It's sitting there absolutely idle. No one is using it. So he said, if you simply build a system so that you leased it out in increments of a tenth of a second, then if the military wanted to use it when they pushed the button on their push-to-talk radio, you would just stop leasing it out. And the result would be you'd have all that spectrum available while meanwhile letting other people utilize it when you don't need it. Lots of new mobile services, but a big problem is most of them have failed because the mobile providers didn't understand the inner logistics of the businesses. And there's a very nice description about this in this book chapter. Lots more future work. Combining mobility, wireless LAN plus GPS, security issues, context and location awareness, new services, using socially correlated user movements. So one of the measurements I've always tried to understand is if each of you had a mobile communications device and you're using the wireless LAN here, what happens at the hour when all of you leave the room, right? there's no usage of the spectrum and the access points here. But what happens? Well, suddenly the cells out in the hallway get large number of new users. And it isn't just this class ending, yes, it's all the other classes that are ending, all at the same time. Right? So years ago I learned that in Berlin there's somebody whose job is to actually watch television, watching things like the different football matches, etc., waiting for the breaks in the game. When everyone runs into the bathroom and uses the toilet, they flush the toilet, what happens? Yes, the water pressure drops. Right? So the trick is, what does the pumping station do? Just before, when they see there's going to be a break, they turn up the water pressure. Right? So these socially correlated issues, I think, are becoming a major issue to address today in mobile networks. We don't do it well. We don't know how to handle these correlated activities. What services do you as students want? What do you need? How will you change the interaction with other students, teachers, faculty, staff, equipment, etc.? But one interesting thing is, I think many of those services are going to be based on audio services. And the reason is, you can use audio while you're walking along. But it's very hard looking at a display while you walk along. It's not impossible, but it's hard. I think it's going to be PDA-like devices, phone-like devices, etc., because they're getting enough computing power, enough storage, the reasonable form factors, etc., and you're going to use them on the move. But that demands, how's the infrastructure going to deal with the correlation of all of these users moving about? There are bunches of new players, some as public services, some for profit, some purely because they think it's a good thing to do, with community networks, commercial networks, business networks, and even, of course, yes, the existing operators. And Johann Holtel recently published a dissertation, which I think is very, very interesting. He uses game theoretic techniques to figure out, if instead of optimizing in an oligopolistic way, i.e. nearly a cartel, we were to give up a little bit of our profit and we were to say, what could we do in terms of reducing the average cost per second per user? And the interesting thing is that by giving up about 10% of our maximal profits, we would be able to increase the efficiency for the user by a factor of 2, which is very interesting. So there are some fascinating activities today in resource pooling. This represents operators cooperating instead of completely competing, as opposed to being completely a monopoly where they say, hey, our customers have no other choice but us. And in here is a win-win for both the customers and the operators. There's some nice papers on resource pooling, and this recent paper by Damon Wischik and others says that resource pooling is the only practical way to achieve resilience at an acceptable cost and to achieve flexibility and high utilization. And there are bunches of examples of this. And one of the fascinating things in Canada of building service centers out in the middle of nowhere and moving gigabits per second instead of gigawatts. And there's lots more reading you can do about all these things. But at that point, since it's now 1601, I'll ask any questions. Hopefully you've heard about some interesting things that you can think of in terms of, yes, that would make an interesting topic for me to write a paper about. If you have questions about your topics, send email. I'm happy to hear from you. I look forward to your papers and your oral presentations. Good luck. Yes?
How does the oral presentation work? Will there
be part of the class? Yes. We'll have them in open area at wireless at KPH. So you come in, you can attend as many as you want. You only need to, of course, attend your own. They'll be scheduled in 20-minute time slots. They're fun to come in here with other people who've been working on. You can learn a lot about it. We should have enough room, I hope, for mostly anyone who wants to come. And when I get your paper, if it looks like it's going for you to be acceptable. I'll send you a time slot and start assigning people to time slots until I fill it. Unless someone, of course, sends me a request earlier saying, I absolutely want to be the first one at 8 o'clock. And, of course, you will get the 8 o'clock slot if you're the first to ask. Okay? Not a question? Yes?
We're going to still send you a document with the...
Yes?
If you don't approve, you won't get a reply.
You'll get a reply, and we'll discuss how to turn it into something that will be a suitable topic.
We will also be something like a review of the first draft of the paper with you.
Only if I get it very, very early.